Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. I'm Stephanie McPheeters, the deputy editor of the Maine Monitor. The Maine Monitor is the nonpartisan, independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to delivering high-quality, nonpartisan, investigative, and explanatory journalism to inform Mainers about issues impacting our state and to empower them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. Each month, a panel of reporters and editors will talk about the stories we are working on, many of which you have likely read in your local newspaper or at themainemonitor.org. This month, I'm joined by the Monitor's healthcare reporter, Emily Bader, to discuss her reporting on substance use issues in Maine. Today, we're going to focus on two unique approaches to recovery that she profiled this summer, one in Machias and one in Millinocket. Before we dive in, I just have a quick announcement. I wanted to mention that the Monitor recently launched a new collaboration with the Associated Press. It'll enhance what the Monitor can offer its readers and broaden the reach of our reporting. The initiative is part of an effort by the AP to expand the reach of local news ahead of the presidential election and increase access to the AP's fact-based nonpartisan journalism. So it's something we're really excited about. Now we'll get to Emily. So Emily, you've been reporting on addiction issues for a while now, and in particular for the Monitor, you've been tracking the money that communities across the state are getting from these opioid settlements. Before we dive into the profiles you did this summer in Machias and in Millinocket, can you tell us a bit about your tracking of this money and just what it is?
Yeah, so Maine is receiving about $230 million across 18 years from settlements with some of the opioid manufacturers, distributors, and retailers. If you've listened to this radio hour before, you've heard me talking about this. It's sort of a huge accountability project because every state was kind of left to its own devices in terms of transparency. And the way Maine has handled it is only the half that is going to the Maine Recovery Council has to be publicly displayed. So I'll backtrack a little bit. So of the $230 million, 50% is going to something called the Maine Recovery Council, 30% is going to 39 different counties, cities, and towns, and 20% is going to the state, specifically the Attorney General's office. Beyond our public records laws, none of this money is necessarily being spent in a public way, as in no one's like necessarily putting out a dashboard saying, this is how much money we're spending here, this is how much money we're spending there. There's no requirements to do that. So because of that, I'm trying to do that on my own by surveying these various recipients every so often. And I've done that twice now. And so far, initial spending is beginning some places. Other places are still trying to figure out how they actually want to spend them. You know, like, are they going to create a council? Are they going to do this through their budget process, like the actual process of spending? And so in that reporting, I found some partially troublesome spending, which again, I talked about in the last radio hour, and some good spending, good as in like advocates and people in recovery say these are how we should be spending our money, like increasing access to medications for opioid use disorder in jails. But what's come of that is also, it's led me to think a lot about gaps in services or where there are the greatest needs. And that's sort of how I landed on these two stories as I was thinking about what are two major areas of need. One is options for women with children are for to get into a recovery residence, like a sober living home, are very limited. And then two, Maine's Wabanaki Nations, their settlement money was negotiated completely separately from the state, and they're getting such a small amount compared to the state. They're getting about 3.5 million, and that's divided amongst all five federally recognized tribes. So that was also getting me thinking about how are organizations trying to serve Wabanaki people who are in recovery.
Yeah, so just remind us, so it's 230 million to the state and it's 3 million to the Wabanaki Nations, is that right? About.
Yes, something like
Okay.
that. Yeah. And
Okay.
that's divided amongst, we have four federally recognized tribes, one of which has two locations with their own governance. So
Right.
split among all those five places over 18 years. So it's really nothing in
Just
comparison.
a drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it sounds like you've been doing all this reporting, looking at this money, this new money that is coming into these communities that is, meant to go toward different harm reduction and treatment and recovery efforts. And some of those decisions, like you said, have been a bit questionable. Some of the money has been put toward uses in law enforcement that a lot of advocates say, does not really fit the bill. And so how did thinking about that spending and the decisions that are being made there and the ways in which those decisions are being made, how did that lead you to these two stories? It sounds like you were trying to look at what's working already, or what were you thinking about there?
Yeah, I mean, I think there were a lot of various factors going on here. I mean, on the one hand, there's all this money coming in. There are people who are not necessarily experts on how to treat opioid use disorder, or just are not public health officials who maybe are super familiar with prevention, treatment, recovery, everything under this umbrella. They're city administrators or county officials who have a million other things to do and now suddenly have this money, which is great. And they have to follow a certain guidelines on how to spend it. And what I think is going on is that faced with these decisions, they want to get the money out, but they're kind of going to what is easiest and the reason I think that is because a lot of it's going to law enforcement, and in cities and counties, that's who is confronted with substance use disorder the most on an everyday basis. So that got me thinking about, like, okay, well, that might be okay. A lot of advocates would say that no money should go towards law enforcement. But it got me thinking about, like, well, what are the issues that need to be focused on? Where are the gaps? And so that's one part. And then another part, I was reporting on something entirely different and just happened to get connected with one of the people who was involved with Safe Harbor Recovery Home in Machias, and was just chatting with this person, and she was like, oh, well, we have this new recovery home. It's really great. And I had also been thinking about Maine has a really high rate of child removals, where a parent or guardian substance use disorder was a contributing factor. And so then it was kind of the confluence of all these different factors that got me thinking about these issues.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So let's talk about this recovery home in Machias. So it's called Safe Harbor. What is it, and how does it work?
So Safe Harbor is a recovery home for women, and they can bring their children if they're under the age of 10. And I mean, there's a lot more detail that goes into that, but they can bring their children, and that's a huge deal. So a recovery home, it's sometimes maybe colloquially referred to as a sober living home. That's kind of this essential step between various forms of maybe someone was in inpatient treatment, Maybe they were incarcerated, maybe they were homeless. And this is what people in recovery tell me, is this is a really important step where people can live in a supportive community where everyone is in recovery and they can kind of get back on their feet. Maybe it's kind of going back to school or learning life skills or doing whatever they need to do to then eventually live independently. The thing about recovery homes is, well, I don't know exactly how many there are in the state because there's no state licensing, but there are about, at last count, about 80 homes that are certified by an association called the Maine Association of Recovery Residences, which certifies based off of this national criteria. And in reporting on this story, I found that only two homes of all those that are certified, which includes Safe Harbor, allow women to move in with their children.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I can explain, like, you know, why that's a big deal. I mean, for one thing, if you're in recovery and you have custody of your children, you probably don't want to separate from them, just generally. And so you can imagine people live there full time. You live there full time. Services are usually provided offsite, because these are not treatment facilities. They're residences. But the other thing that got me thinking about this, like I said, was over 50% of children that are removed from their homes are because of a parent's substance use disorder. And so part of what goes into regaining custody is going to treatment and recovery. And so you're going through this critical time where you are trying to either get custody back, or maybe you have a reunification plan. And part of that is beginning to live with your child again or having visits. And there's so many places that just don't allow you to come with your children. I mean, you can imagine bringing children into a living situation just complicates things a million times over. But that, for the people I spoke to at Safe Harbor, including the residents and the people who work there, that is really critical to a lot of people. And this Safe Harbor has 5 beds. The one other place I believe has like maybe 10. So that's 15 beds in the entire state where a woman in recovery can go with her child. And there's a lot of women who are in recovery looking for this sort of, with children, who are looking for this sort of living situation.
Yeah, that is a pretty remarkable number. And I'm curious, I mean, can you tell me a little bit about it? It sounds like it makes a lot of sense. Who's behind this house, and, you know, why did they decide to build a recovery home that allows women and children, and you know, what were some of the challenges they faced when they decided to do this? Because it sounds like it's a pretty unique approach to this problem.
Yeah, it is. So it's a collaboration between 4 organizations. It's Healthy Acadia, Community Caring Collaborative, Down East Community Partners, and Aristic Mental Health Center. And about, I think it's 5 years ago now or so, various people from those organizations got together and they were starting to discuss opening a recovery residence. And they were thinking through, what do we want this residence to look like? And they told me they fairly quickly came on the conclusion that they wanted to open a place for women, and they wanted to open a place for women with children. And a couple of the women, including the now manager, and one of the women who was involved in, two of the women who were involved in these conversations, said that they couldn't imagine that opening a place, a recovery residence, without allowing children, because what they hear so often is that people in recovery need safe and stable housing and they need transportation. And so why not tackle one of these things, safe and stable housing? And yeah, so I mean, through when they were telling me that, you know, at first they kind of were told, like, you don't want to do that. You don't want to invite kids in because that's, again, like a whole, you know, can of worms that's going to be really difficult. But they just decided like this was too important to do. And clearly there's a need. They're the only certified recovery residents in all of Washington County, and I believe all of Hancock County too. So all of Down East Maine. So there's just this huge gap. And they just said, well, if no one's going to do it, if we're not going to do it, no one's going to do it.
And I think some of the, if I remember correctly, some of the people involved in building this home and in this idea were in recovery themselves. Is that right? So they sort of had understanding of what this would mean to people.
Yeah, several of the women are, yeah, in long-term recovery themselves. They have children. And they had talked about, like, they could not imagine if when they were in early recovery, having to leave their children. And they said that, you know, had they had to leave their children, they probably never would have been able to sustain their recovery. I mean, it's already traumatic enough. There's a lot of research behind separating mothers and parents from their children, a lot of trauma for both the parent and the child, especially in those early stages of development. It's really important to keep kids together as much as possible. Of course, there are exceptions. There are times where it's simply not safe. And I'm not trying to litigate that at all. But in instances where that a child being with their mother can really kind of help, I mean, that's part of your support and, you know, your family. So you want to keep them with you and can really help support you through that process, or at the very least, not be a distraction. I mean, I can only imagine how difficult it must be to try and work through early recovery while you're thinking about your child who's, you know, miles away. So these women, yeah, so they have firsthand experience, and they did make it very clear that, you know, they didn't have to make that choice, but were they forced to make that choice, it would have been extremely difficult for them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I want to hear more about the woman you met and sort of how you approach the reporting process. We need to take a quick break first. You're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. This month, we're here with healthcare reporter Emily Bader to discuss substance use issues in Maine. In particular, we're taking a solutions look at the issue, looking at two approaches in Machias and in Millinocket. One is focused on women in recovery and their children, and one is focused on the Wabanaki Nations. So, Emily, to get back into our discussion of Safe Harbor, you know, this is obviously a very sensitive topic. I'm curious, you know, when you went about approaching the reporting and trying to talk to people who were staying at Safe Harbor, or who had been there before, you know, how did you approach those conversations, and you know, what were you thinking about as you were talking to these women who were staying there?
Yeah, so I mean, I started with talking with the house manager and some of the people who are involved in the operations and part of the who were the same people who were part of those initial discussions. So I had some conversations with them before I visited Safe Harbor and, you know, talked through like what the home is and their goals and, you know, everything that goes into it and kind of the nitty gritty, and then set up a time to actually go and visit. I knew that this was going to be something where I wanted to be able to meet people in person, because you're right, like this is a very sensitive topic and I think it's best done face to face. But basically, I mean, I went in, I didn't know exactly who I was going to speak to, but Katie Sell and Penny Geisinger and Lauren Sachs, who all work at the home or are part of Healthy Acadia, basically prepared the women who lived there and said, there's a reporter coming, you know, she would love to speak with some of you, but there's no pressure. And I just Luckily enough, I walked in and there were a couple of women who were willing to chat with me, and we just sat in the living room and had a long conversation. And then I also spoke with two other women who previously lived at the home, and that those were also connections from the managers. And these are women who they knew were very proud of their journey and proud of talking, you know, discussing what they went through. And I also met up with them in person. And yeah, so I mean, these are, yeah, tough conversations. But I think we were focusing on safe harbors being a solution. And I think that really helped drive the conversation, because these women have made a lot of strides in their recovery. I mean, two of them are living, you know, regular lives. They are reunified with their children. They're going back to school, or they're studying to be recovery coaches. Like, they've made a lot of strides. And so it was a lot easier to talk about those things, because they could, you know, we could really focus on all the successes they've had in overcoming those challenges that are tough to talk about.
Yeah, that makes sense. So can you tell us a bit about what those challenges looked like? And, you know, I know for some of them, it was really hard to find a place to land, and they, you know, felt very lucky, it seems like, to find safe harbor where they could bring their children. But what did that sort of process look like for them?
Yeah, so one of the women I spoke to, who's a former resident, we called her Helen. We ended up using pseudonyms for everyone, because this is, you know, we wanted to protect everyone's privacy. And there are a lot of this, it just felt like the right decision for this story and in discussion with them. But anyway, Helen, yeah, so she formerly lived at the home. She was there, I believe, about a year. And she was telling me, so she has a 10-year-old daughter, and she's been using drugs, or had been using drugs, since she was a preteen, and kind of had various bouts of sobriety. And in her words, she had fallen off the wagon again. And the Office of Child and Family Services came in and they said, you need to get sober and then you can get your kid back. And they took her child, who went to live with a family member. And so Helen went to a 6-month inpatient treatment program through Wellspring in Penobscot County. And she knew that she wanted to go to recovery residence when she was done with inpatient treatment. But she was telling me that, one, she was having a lot of trouble finding a place. And then, two, she was having trouble just understanding what her caseworker kind of wanted from her. She said her caseworker changed multiple times. She felt like every time she would meet a goal, the goalpost would move. And she described that she was on the last day at Wellspring. It was her graduation. And she had just found out that she got a spot at Safe Harbor. And there are two reasons why Safe Harbor was so important for her. Is one, she wanted to be able to bring her daughter, if that could be part of the reunification plan. And then two, she was on medication for opioid use disorder, which a lot of recovery residences don't allow. And Safe Harbor does. So she literally on the last day found out she got one of the 5 beds. She's said she was calling and calling and calling her caseworker. Finally, they pick up and they say, yes, that's fine. And I think like a couple of days later, she moved in. And so it was, I mean, can imagine, she said to me that if she hadn't managed to find Safe Harbor, she doesn't know where she would be. She said she may have just ended up on the streets, because she would have had nowhere to go. And she was at Safe Harbor for about a year, and now she's living in her own place. Her daughter is back with her. It, you know, her and her daughter are doing really, really well. She's studying to become a recovery coach, but she had to jump through so many different hoops to get to that point. And it's kind of the scary story of, I mean, it's a hopeful story, but also a little scary to think, like, what if that one bed hadn't opened up? She doesn't know what she would have done.
Yeah, that is scary to think about. So what happened once she got to the home? What does their programming look like? And obviously they take children, so that is, something that sets them apart. But how else are they different from other recovery homes, and how else are they similar?
Yeah, I think they're pretty similar to a lot of other recovery homes in that there aren't services provided on site. So like counseling, you're gonna go kind of off site, like outside of the home, because they're not a treatment provider. But they do things like I believe every week the residents need to do two community activities or recovery focused activities. So that might be going to an NA meeting, it might be going to an event in town, just something that's focused on their recovery and also any connections with their kids or community. So I mean, to describe this home, it just looks like a home. It reminds me of kind of like an old New England dorm almost, which is like a home, but there's multiple rooms, I guess.
A shared kitchen, right? Kind of.
And I mean, everyone is responsible for cooking their own meals, for everyone has weekly chores, they're on rotation, they have meetings, like as a home, kind of. I mean, it is sort of like a dorm-like experience. You're living with four other people plus maybe their children or your children. And yeah, I mean, I think the only difference is that between maybe like a dorm and other places is there's more structure, and that you have certain things you have to do every week, and also everyone's in recovery. So it's also very supportive because there's a understanding between everyone, and everyone's kind of cheering each other on.
Yeah. Well, so going back to how you approach the story and getting these women to open up to you. I know one of the things we talked about in the editing process is that we wanted everything to be accurate as we always do, but we also wanted to make sure that the woman who you were speaking to understood which pieces of their story were going to be out there in the public. And you did some pretty intensive fact-checking calls with them. Can you tell us about sort of how those went and what you were thinking about during that process?
I mean, so I've been reporting on substance use for a while, and I've spoken to a lot of people at various stages of the recovery. And one thing I've learned is that a lot of people like to go about their recovery in this sort of recovery out loud philosophy. And that's wonderful and great, but I think with any sort of interview with anyone, regardless of who they are, you have to establish that you're on the record, and that sometimes things that they may be really excited to share may not be the best thing, especially where there's children and invest like OCFS investigative cases involved. But that's all to say, I mean, I just, when I was going into these interviews, I just was made it very clear, like, I'm a reporter. This is on the record. What you tell me right now, it's if it gets into the story, it's online in perpetuity. So just being very mindful of that, especially given, some of these couple of the women were still living at the home, and they're trying to maybe find a job or just whatever it may be. So yeah, I mean, I think there's a little bit of sensitivity. You have to approach the story with a little bit of sensitivity. And then when you're dealing with, I think, anyone's personal stories, you want to make sure you get it right and fact check as much as you can. Just as intensely as you can, both people's stories, like making sure that you got it correct and then that it's accurate. So I just, These women were very open, and they gave me a lot of their time and talking about really tough things. And they also spent a lot of time with me making sure that I was telling their story correctly and accurately. I mean, we were talking about details dating back, years about how they first got into drugs and then how they found recovery and their experiences with OCFS. So I just, we took a lot of care with that.
Yeah, and I think it's worth, us talking a little bit about what fact-checking is and what that process looks like for us, because I think, that's not something that people necessarily understand. I think sometimes people want to see the story before publication, and they want to make sure, they just want to read the story and make sure it looks okay. And that's not something we do at the Monitor. It's not something that most traditional news organizations do, because we want to it's just a matter of integrity in our own sort of our own work, but we do want to make sure everything is accurate, and there's a way to do that without sending the full story out to a source before publication, and that's by just giving them a call, right? And talking through the facts that are in there, and sort of at length making sure all the details are correct. So yeah, can you just tell us a bit about sort of how you went about that process?
Yeah, so I basically made lists for every single person I talked to about all the facts in the story, whether that's, the group of four community organizations began meeting in 2018, or you told me that you had a back injury and was prescribed oxycodone, and that is what prompted your addiction to painkillers. Like those are all facts that I go through. And yeah, I set up a time and I pick up the phone and I go line by line, say, is it correct that, XYZ? Is it correct that XYZ? I luckily, I think everything was, sometimes things can come up in that process where if you don't understand something correctly the first time, but I think everything went really smoothly, which was really nice because it was a lot of fact checking. So I spoke to all the organizations that were involved, every person I interviewed on the management side, all of the women I spoke to again. And we had a really great photographer, Catherine Emery, take photos, and we were very, again, like super cognizant of protecting everyone's privacy. And so we wanted to make sure that, all these women gave us permission to show their faces, and but we ultimately decided that we were going to try and limit that as much as possible for various reasons that
Well, particularly for the kids, right? Yeah.
we didn't, I mean, you can maybe see like a profile, but we, even though these women gave us permission to show their child's face, we ultimately decided not to. And that was also in consultation with journalists from a group called Reporting on Addiction, who are really experts in reporting on addiction, and were able to kind of talk us through both like the fact checking, when we were faced with maybe a detail that could be compromising to a person's safety, how are we going to handle that if it was said on the record, and just people's identities in general, because it's important that these stories are told, but it should not be at the expense of the people who are giving us their time and opening up themselves to allow us to tell these stories.
Right. And there's a different standard when you're reporting on a public figure or when you're
Oh
reporting
yeah.
on an
Yeah.
ordinary person. And so in this case, we wanted to be sensitive to their experiences and their stories. Yeah.
Absolutely. I would be a lot more, I don't want to say harsh, but I would not be as I would not give them as much space if they were a public figure, I would say.
Yeah, there's a different standard.
Yeah.
Okay, well let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, we should get into talking about your other story, which looks at the Healing Lodge in Millinocket. You are listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. This month, we're here with healthcare reporter Emily Bader to discuss substance use issues in Maine. She was just telling us about Safe Harbor in Machias, a recovery home for women and children. And next, we're going to be talking about the way Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness is approaching addiction treatment for the Wabanaki Nations in Maine. So, Emily, yeah, can you tell us just where did the idea for this second story come from? What prompted you to look into the work that Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness were doing?
Yeah, so this really did start with trying to figure out how everyone was set it was spending their settlement money. Like I said before, the money that's going to Maine's tribes is completely separate from the state money. It beyond just directing me to the website, like the Attorney General's office has no idea what's happening, and they're the people who know what how or who are handling the state money, I should say. So I was trying to figure that out. I had been reaching out to all of the chiefs and trying to find out what was going on. I wasn't really having much luck. And then my colleague Rose Lundy was like, "Oh, well, you should try Lisa Sakabazin at Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness. She's great. She'll chat with you. She might know." So I gave her a call, and what came of that conversation was I kind of shifted a little bit because I realized there was a really interesting story right there. Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness is not connected to the tribes officially, but I mean they do work with them in terms of providing programs and services, but they're completely separate. They're not part of tribal governance at all. But they are a public health agency of sorts that serves Wabanaki people, and they have a huge opioid or substance use treatment and recovery program kind of within their organization. And in talking with Lisa, I was curious, like how does spending, the opioid settlement money, how might it looked different for the Wabanaki tribes? And she was describing that, saying that what people really need is culturally sensitive recovery practices. And so that kind of got me started looking into the Healing Lodge and other programs and really understanding like what recovery looks like for a member of a Wabanaki nation might look different than a non-native person.
Yeah, so what is culturally sensitive treatment, and what, where is the need for that coming from? Or what did they tell you about that?
Yeah, so I mean, it's so the need, I think, also explains the culturally sensitive part. So what culturally sensitive or culturally aware, it means kind of to really at a basic level, it means one, you're incorporating more indigenous healing practices into recovery practices. And then two, it's really being more aware of the history of indigenous people and Wabanaki people in Maine. And those are kind of two things that Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness, for one, is trying to do. They have this kind of recovery and community and healing center called the Healing Lodge in downtown Millinocket. And it's where their intensive outpatient program is based, which follows all the same guidelines as any other, as pretty much any other intensive outpatient program. But, instead of offering Alcoholics Anonymous groups, which is pretty heavily Christian influenced. They offer Wellbriety, which is a program that was developed in the 90s out in Colorado. And that really incorporates a lot of Indigenous practices about kind of centering yourself or grounding yourself, both mind and body, and, you know, using various Indigenous healing practices. It's kind of hard to explain, almost like, I mean, I do explain it in the story, but, you know, there are little and big ways that certain approaches to recovery are kind of substituted. So maybe instead of a group meeting, it's more like a talking circle where you have a talking stick and the room is set up that it's more kind of in a traditional Indigenous talking circle like setting, or you have programs that incorporate sweat lodges, which, you know, or cooking classes that where you learn how to make Passamaquoddy or meals with traditional Passamaquoddy ingredients. So it's all these little things. And part of that, again, getting back to like why it's necessary, is that throughout Maine and this country's history, there have been government sanctioned efforts to remove people from their native communities and their native identities. And so, as Lisa was telling me, and as some other folks I spoke to were telling me, it's part of recovery is not just, you know, the substance use itself. It's also addressing the trauma of those experiences, intergenerational trauma, that you can't have one without the other. You have to address those things in order to address the substance use, because they're often co-occurring.
Yeah, everything's connected. I mean, I think, so you went up to Millinocket and you went to the Healing Lodge. Can you, you know, we're talking on the radio right now. Yeah. Can you sort of paint a picture for us of what it looked like and what these sort of different spaces are? Because I think that really gets to, you know, what these spaces look like, gets at this, you know, the sort of different approach they're taking there. And we sent, you know, the same photographer who worked on your Safe Harbor story, Catherine Emery, we sent her to the Healing Lodge as well. And I think the photos are really beautiful and striking. And you can really get a sense just from the photos of kind of what a unique space this is. And yeah, if you could sort of walk us through the house and or through the lodge, give us a tour, that'd be great.
Yeah. It's a really beautiful space. So it's in downtown Millinocket, which is sort of the gateway to Maine's North Woods. It's, you know, if you want to hike Mount Katahdin, you're probably going to drive through Millinocket on your way to the Baxter State Woods, which I should note is a culturally very important place for Wabanaki people. It's very sacred, especially Mount Katahdin, which is an actual, I believe it's Penobscot word. But anyway, so it reminds me of like a Lincoln Logs building on the outside. I mean, this was a former restaurant owned by a logging family, the Pelletier family. They had a Discovery Channel show. So as you can imagine, it's very wood focused.
Sounds like it. Yep.
Yeah. And you walk in, and the first thing I noticed when I walked in is it smelled great. It smelled like freshly burnt firewood and sage and sweetgrass. And they even have a CD player playing traditional Wabanaki music. So it's just a very calming space. And Lisa took me on a tour of the space, and she was kind of showing me all these different touches they put into the space. So like you even have, there's glass that's inlaid with sweetgrass, which are one of the four medicines and Indigenous and Wabanaki culture. Everything is meant to feel more like a home or like a lodge rather than a clinical space you might go into for, you know, counseling or something like that. It's really beautifully decorated. Lisa goes to a photographer in town where we actually stop by and buys all the artwork there. And it's all these, Steph and I were, you know, we were talking while we were editing about how much we loved one of the photos of Moose. And so it's, and there's also, you know, signs in the different Wabanaki languages. Like there's all these little things that Lisa was telling me are meant to remind people of home, whether they grew up on one of the reservations or home in sort of a cultural, spiritual sense, like a place that reminds them of where they came from. And there's, I mean, they kept, there's still an industrial grade kitchen there where they do cooking classes, but it doesn't look like a restaurant kitchen. It looks like just a really nice home kitchen. And there's all these meeting spaces upstairs. There's kind of a common area where people, they also have meetings where they clear it out. They have like yoga and karate or some sort of martial arts class. I'm totally blanking out what it was exactly, but I remember hearing it and thinking, oh. And then they have private rooms where counselors and social workers can meet with clients. And they do have a nurses, an actual exam room for the nurses who work there. So it's a really homey, beautiful space. It doesn't feels very welcoming. And that's what Lisa said that they were trying to do. They wanted people to feel at home when they go there. And it's not meant to just be a recovery center. It's meant to be, as she described it, a healing center and a community center. So, you know, maybe you're a parent who's going in for a group meeting, but there's, you know, it's comfortable for you to bring your kid and they can play a board game and, you know, play with other kids or someone's grandma or whoever's there while they're in their meeting.
That sounds great. Who doesn't love a good board game?
Yeah.
So can you were telling us a little bit about this, you know, different kind of approach to the 12-step program that, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous comes from a, you know, a very Christian background and that they're using this other one. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that works? And I know you talked to the program director of the intensive outpatient program, what he was telling you about sort of how he approaches that piece of it.
Yeah. So I spoke to Robert Dalpy, who, yeah, is in charge of the inpatient program. And yeah, so I actually, somewhere on my desk, I have their like program schedule. But you know, there are certain things that are kind of standard, like you're going to have meetings with counselors, or, you know, group therapy sessions. But like I said, those might look a little more like a talking circle. Some of their clinicians and counselors are Indigenous themselves. I think 60% of Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness's staff are Indigenous. So there's just that kind of cultural familiarity. And so there's certain things that are just kind of standard that you might find anywhere, those sort of more clinical things. But then they also have activities in their schedule, like cultural activities. Maybe they go down to Bangor for an afternoon where Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness also has another community center. Or like Robert was describing, one of, you know, a friend of theirs comes in who is he's a medical doctor, but he's a really avid forager, and he could just knows about just about everything about anything you can point out in a forest. And so he'll take people foraging and kind of like teach them about the different things. Or it's picking and braiding sweetgrass. Like there are these certain activities that are just more geared towards sort of Wabanaki culture, where it might, you know, the actual outline of the schedule might look like anywhere else, but what's actually filled into those spaces is just more focused on Wabanaki people and, you know, what brings them close to home. And, oh, I should also mention a huge part of everything was, you know, group meetings, any kind of gathering starts with a smudge ceremony, which is where you burn the four medicines. cedar, sage, sweetgrass, and tobacco. And all these medicines have different purposes. And it's sort of just like a reset and getting out the bad energy, bringing in the good energy, and bringing protection to the space. And Lisa and Robert showed me a smudge ceremony, and which was, I mean, it was very special. They're kind of showing me like what you do. And Lisa was saying like she keeps a little smudge kit just in her car, just, you know, when she needs it or just to start the day. And I think that's also just, that's kind of like level setting and bringing you down to earth and getting started. But we have, I mean, Catherine took really beautiful photos of the medicines and the, you know, everything used in a smudge ceremony.
Yeah, they are very beautiful. If people want to check them out online. So in addition to this, the Healing Lodge, Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness also has a number of recovery residences, right? Going back to this, you know, this idea of recovery residences that we were talking about with Safe Harbor. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, where those are and what they look like? And you also spoke to someone who went through one of them, right? And can you tell us a bit about his story?
Yeah. So I should go back. I connected with a man named Steve Knockwood, who is their, I'm trying to recall his exact title. He is their, oh my gosh, I'm sorry, listeners. He's a recovery coach and outreach specialist. There we go. So he works a lot of times within the tribes, like at the reservations or just with people. I got the impression he's very well connected. And, you know, he could just help guide people to resources available to them, whether that's at Wabanaki Public Health or wherever that may be. And so I got connected to him through Lisa, and then he was able to connect me with the man that we called John for privacy purposes. But John, he is Passamaquoddy, and he went through one of Wabanaki Public Health and Wellness's recovery homes called Opportunity House. And he was describing to me that he has been dealing with substance use disorder since he was a kid, pretty much. And really, he'd never had any long-term periods, any sustainable long-term periods of sobriety. He described, like, he thinks the longest period he's ever been sober was 100 days at a rehab facility in North Carolina when he was 16. And so someone got connected to Steve Knockwood about and said, hey, John needs help. John couldn't exactly remember, like, you know, those initial conversations with Steve, but Steve basically, like, John agreed to go to treatment. Steve picked him up, drove him to Maine General Hospital in Augusta. He went to detox for a few weeks. Then Steve picked him up when he was done there and drove him to Bella's house, which is a recovery residence, a residential treatment facility. There we go. And then when he left that program, Steve picked him up again and brought him to Opportunity House. And he was telling me he had this feeling that like every day was Groundhog's Day, where he would wake up and he felt like it was the same thing over and over again. He didn't feel like he had a purpose or direction, and he didn't really know what was missing per se. And when he got to Opportunity House, he said at first he was kind of like, whoa, who are these people? Why are they being so, you know, kind and generous to me? He kind of said, you know, through his various experiences in treatment programs, he kind of had become distrustful of people. But over time, he realized that, like, oh, these people are here to help me. And not only are they here to help me, but they're kind of like me. They come from the same place, or they have the same cultural understanding as me. And he said that it just, over time, what made the difference to him is that he was around his people, as he called it, and it just felt comfortable and familiar and safe. And that really ultimately made the difference, because now he's, I think, a year into his sobriety, or longer than he has ever been before. And he, you know, is starting to make progress in his life for the first time. And he said that it really made all the difference being around people who are just like him.
Well, that's a very hopeful note. And we're running out of time, so that might be the hopeful note that we end on. But thank you, Emily, for talking us through both of those stories. I think, oftentimes reporting on addiction issues and just healthcare in general can sometimes it can be pretty data heavy, and sometimes the policy discussions can be pretty wonky. And so I think both of these stories really gave us sort of a real look at what the challenges are and what two approaches are to solving them or solving a small piece of them. So I think that was really useful. And speaking of deep looks into healthcare issues in the state, I just want to tell readers before we go, or listeners, sorry, I'm so used to addressing readers, but here we are on the radio. Listeners, about a recent story that another one of our healthcare reporters, Rose Lundy, did recently about a nursing home in Caribou and the owner there who just recently had to shut down his nursing home in Presque Isle, and sort of the challenges he's facing as one of the owners and the president of this nursing home. So I would recommend people read that, as well as we have an ongoing series right now from our editor, Kate Koff, about Maine's salt marshes and all of the challenges that those are facing given climate change. So you can find all of that on our website. You've been listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a collaboration between WERU-FM and the nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We were joined today by healthcare reporter Emily Bader. You can read her work at themainemonitor.org and in newspapers across the state. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. And if you have stories that you want to share with Emily Bader, you can reach her at emily@themainemonitor.org. The Maine Monitor Radio Hour is broadcast on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can also listen on the WERU app, subscribe to the show as a podcast, or download archived shows at weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Stephanie McPheeters, and this is Community Radio WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill. Thanks, everyone.